without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Branch's longtime friend, Alan Banoff, who is a longtime NELA member, has served on the board of the Metropolitan Washington Employment Lawyers Association. Alan tells me that he's a big wig in the Maryland Democratic State Party. Yay. We are so pleased to have Alan introduce Taylor Branch as our keynote speaker. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. Taylor Branch and I grew up in the segregated South. I'm from Charleston. He's from here in Atlanta. I met him in the 1960s at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you, Michelle. Chapel Hill was an oasis, a liberal oasis in a conservative desert back in the 1960s. It formed us a great deal in how we viewed the world and civil rights. I knew back in the 60s that Taylor had a great sense of justice because he was the chair of the Honor System Commission and the director of the Department of Judicial Affairs in the UNC student government. He later earned a master's degree at Princeton and was assistant editor for the Washington Monthly, a political journal. In 1972, he worked in the McGovern campaign. He was the co-coordinator for Texas with somebody else you may have heard of, Bill Clinton, one of the other people who worked on the campaign at the time was one of their friends, Hillary Rodham. You may have heard of her, too. Taylor has been a prolific author. Among the books he wrote or co-wrote were Blowing the Whistle, Dissent in the Public Interest with Charles Peters, Second Wind with Bill Russell, the basketball player, The Cartel, Inside the Rise and Imminent Fall of the NCAA. President Clinton asked Taylor to interview him and serve as his diarist during his presidency. Between 1993 and 2001, Taylor turned their 79 confidential conversations into the Clinton tapes, Wrestling History with the President, which he published in 2009. He sings with a trio, Off Our Rocker, covering Beatles songs. But what identifies Taylor as one of the preeminent American historians of modern times was his trilogy, America in the King Years, Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge, covering the period collectively from 1954 to 1968. He spent 24 years and 2,306 pages writing it. In the King Years, historic moments in the civil rights movement, Taylor explains this passion. I was not born or raised to care about politics, let alone to write history. The landmark Brown decision of 1954 had caught me, a white first grader in segregated Atlanta, Georgia, and my college graduation 14 years later closely followed the King assassination. Through all the formative years in between, I remained fearfully oblivious to race, until the relentless freedom movement redirected my entire life's interest. Permanent curiosity drove what would become a career ambition. As an outsider, I needed to learn what had sustained such resonant witness among near peers of African descent. For Parting the Waters, Taylor won the Pulitzer Prize for History in 1989. He's also won the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Lifetime Achievement Award, and the National Humanities Medal. He is currently working on a TV miniseries based upon his King Years trilogy. I am thrilled and honored to introduce Taylor Branch as keynote speaker for this 25th NELA convention.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Terry. Welcome, NELA. I am not a lawyer. I want to apologize in advance. But I love the law, and I want to talk to you a little bit about things that may bear on your specialty from the standpoint of a historian who specialized in the race issue. Employment is crucial. Historical perspective, to me, is crucial. I was driving with my mother yesterday to see where the neighborhood where I was born in Buckhead near the corner of Peachtree and Piedmont, and there was a gigantic billboard there that said, "Hire a dog trainer so you won't have to hire a rug cleaner." And it made me think of you as that basically this is a dispute over who gets hired and whose job is secure and whose job is not. But it trivializes the challenge that you face in a world where millions of jobs are being displaced, and the question is whether that is the function of efficiency and progress or injustice. And it seems to me that even to address those questions, you have to have some sense of history. And I'd like to go back a long way, although in the span of history, it's only a blink. If you look 100 years ago, 90% of Americans were on farms. That was the job. It's only 100 years ago. But not only that, the world was canopied with autocrats. A sultan, the empress dowager, a czar, a whole series of monarchs around the world. Democracy was still considered an infant pretender that was kind of a joke. In 1910, at the funeral of King Henry Edward VII, they made Teddy Roosevelt march way in the rear behind the carriages and the horses of all the assembled royalty of the world as a Republican representative. The world has changed so much in that time in ways that do affect employment. Alan asked me to talk about some of the obscure things in the way we remember and don't remember the driving force behind a lot of these changes. One of them he asked me to talk about, the only one really, was the Howard Smith Amendment in 1964. Some of you probably know about that. That's how we got gender equality into the Equal Employment Law in 1964. It was before the House of Representatives in February 1964, and Howard Smith, the chairman of the Rules Committee from Virginia and an ardent segregationist, as a last gasp effort to derail the Civil Rights Bill, introduced the word sex, saying we want to ban discrimination in employment not just on the basis of race but also sex. The idea, the House of Representatives erupted in laughter that this was considered a ridiculous notion, that you wouldn't even be able to have men and women's bathrooms if this were true. And Speaker McCormick said, this amendment may be out of order, but I certainly understand it. My wife gives me the last two words of every argument, and they are, "Yes, dear." So this is what happened. And Lyndon Johnson in the White House was put to a crisis. Are we going to accept this amendment or fight it as a potential derailer to addressing race relations and racial inequality in employment for the first time in 100 years? And he decided to embrace the amendment. What Johnson said was that the Southerners outsmarted themselves in the House. They tried to kill civil rights by adding sex to it, and all they did was get about 20 million of Lady Bird's friends on our side. That's how gender equality entered the law in the modern era only 50 years ago. And 50-year spans of how we think about equality and employment is useful to give us some perspective on how we are now. It's hard to remember the separation that governed our imaginations on employment only 50 years ago. I've never seen an episode of Mad Men, in part because, to me, having studied this, it is so painful. But it's easy to forget how separate the worlds were by gender and in the law back then. Alan and I were at the University of North Carolina. By state law, it was roughly 5% female, the student body. It was mostly nursing students and a few junior transfers. Women were scarce by law in a state university. The University of Virginia State University had none at all by state law. And the idea that women would be admitted to most private institutions, including Yale and Princeton, was considered preposterous, let alone the notion that they would be cadets at West Point and the Air Force Academy. That was beyond imagination, almost as far beyond imagination as the notion of gay rights and same-sex marriage. My point to you is that dealing at last with the great division of race relations opened stubborn gates for freedom that we forget, that we take for granted, and that have distorted our sense of politics ever since. A year later, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, putting gender equality in employment, at the first press conference of the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, the chairman, FDR Jr., was asked about enforcement, and he fielded a whole bunch of questions, and finally at the end, somebody said, well, what about the sex amendment? And he said, sex, I'm all for it. And they all laughed, and the idea of enforcing this thing was considered preposterous even then, a year later into it. I don't know whether you remember it or not. Maybe you do because of law. It was illegal in many states for women to serve on juries. Hoyt v. Florida in 1961, the Supreme Court upheld a Florida statute from 1960 that provided that it was legal for Florida to say that women could not serve on juries unless they went down to the courthouse and signed an affidavit affirming that they wanted to be considered for jury duty and that it would not interfere with their homemaking. The court upheld that in 1961. In 1966, there were many, many states where it was illegal for women to serve on juries of any kind, petty juries, grand juries, any kind of jury, civil jury. Alabama, in 1966, White v. Crook, you can look it up, overturned the Alabama law that prohibited any female juries. This was in a Klan murder case, the Viola Liuzzo case. She was murdered at the end of Selma. Her killers were acquitted. By custom, there were no black people on the jury, but by state law, there were no females until White v. Crook overturned that and 17 other state laws that restricted the right of females to serve on juries. The New York Times in 1966 still had the want ads divided, help wanted male, help wanted female. And the most common category for help wanted female was Girl Friday. It took another 8 years for Title IX, which was to be passed in 1972, whose goal was to pry open the doors of professional schools that closed for women in engineering, in pharmacy, in a whole host of things like that. And it was only an afterthought that people said, this might apply to sports, to college sports. The prevailing notion of sports for women at that time were called exercise, female exercise classes. The ones who played basketball couldn't cross the half-court line. They had to take the ball there and give it to somebody else. You could only go halfway. The idea was that women were so delicate that if they ran the whole length of the court, their uterus might fall out. The NCAA, from its inception in 1906 until 1981, 9 years after Title IX, never sponsored a single intercollegiate sporting event involving women. They fought Title IX tooth and nail, and then, of course, when they lost, they came in and ran women's sports, had their first soccer tournaments, their first basketball tournaments. Women's Final Four in basketball didn't exist. It's a relatively new phenomenon. Having to do with equal citizenship in doors opened by the racial civil rights movement in the 1960s. Even then, they weren't done. The NCAA cooperated with the Reagan administration to get Title IX overturned by the court. The Reagan administration considered Title IX, and you can see there are news stories from the time that say this, citing sources in the cabinet. We consider this the lesbian's Bill of Rights, and we're against it. and they overturned it, and it was only Bob Dole, good old Bob Dole, who passed the Civil Rights Restoration Act over Reagan's veto in 1988 to firmly establish Title IX, not only for women in professional schools, but also in college sports. It has created a revolution unlike any other that I have ever known. We are now, just now, having the first generation of young female athletes who are able to learn how to play real competitive sports with everything that that means for their confidence, for their sense of teamwork in the world. They're able now for the first time to learn that from their sisters and their mothers, from people who learned it before them, because in the previous generation they had to learn it from their brothers and fathers. It didn't exist. This is how much the world has changed. And as employment lawyers, I want to tell you that, and I'm not going to talk about this very much because this is an age where people in my position about college sports in the NCAA are viewed like abolitionists were before the Civil War. But I believe that one day we will look back and slap our heads and say, how in the world, for all these years, did we allow collusion outside the force of law in which the major universities in the big-time commercial sports agreed that we were going to monopolize all the revenue and demonize any athletes who sought to get a nickel of the revenue that they generate. We were going to demonize them. $14 million of the $20 million undergraduate college students in the United States have some sort of job, part-time or full-time. Nobody dreams that the conditions of their employment should be regulated anywhere except for the few who are athletes. And they are regulated in ways that would make North Korea envious. They can't get a Christmas card from an agent. And all of that is a collusion that I believe will end one day and create a lot of jobs for employment lawyers for college athletes. A lot of them. And I hope it will happen soon, but it is an evidence of how brainwashed we are that even I, when I started doing the history of college sports, I wanted somehow to give the university back to Socrates and get all the money out of it and that sort of thing. And it took me a long time to be able to separate the NCAA's mantra of student-athlete. They refuse... This, if you listen to an NCAA spokesperson, they use the phrase student-athlete in every sentence because they're trying to fuse together roles that by logic and law should be separate. What you do in the classroom is separate from what you do on the field where you're generating money for the university. In the classroom, the university is delivering value to you. But they fuse it together and brainwash people to be unable to separate those two functions so that the result is we get the worst of both worlds. Athletes in college are treated as athletes in the classroom, meaning that the professors don't care about them, and they're treated as students out on the field where they're generating millions and millions of dollars. Students, meaning that if you want any rights, you're like a student asking for a better grade. And no, it's up to us, and we're going to keep all the money, and we're going to do it for your own good so that you can enjoy the blessings of amateurism. So that's how we are stuck. But only in sports. We are stuck in a much more serious way by the condition of our politics, the condition of our view about race and about jobs in an era in which jobs are being displaced by the hundreds of thousands every day. And I want to say, as somebody from Baltimore, somebody where we have Freddie Gray, where I've just been going to a lot of enormous number of people in Baltimore, kids have been showing up for nonviolent workshops in the last month. And I have been going to them. The first time I went, they promised me 20 students, and there were over 200 there. There's a lot going on in Baltimore. But the first thing that's going on applies to all of the shocks that have been accumulating in the last year couple of years since Trayvon Martin, and on in Cleveland and in Baltimore and twice in Charleston, the videotaped murder, and now the murders just a couple of weeks ago. The bottom line is that in the United States, the police problem is really a jobs problem, and the jobs problem can be best understood as through the lens of racial history. How we convince ourselves of things. Race has always been this stubborn gate to freedom. What that means is that it measures our inspiration and our progress, but it also measures not only where we deceive ourselves, but where we roadblock those things in the way we think about politics. It happened, and we do it regularly. It's not like this is the first time this has happened. After the Civil War, the United States busily misremembered what happened in the Civil War, such that when I was growing up in Atlanta, I was taught that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. That was in our textbooks, and that the slaves were better off here as slaves than they were eating each other back in Africa. That was the established view. It took a long time, but it wasn't just Southerners who did that. Textbooks to this day refer to the period in which Reconstruction was overthrown and white supremacy was restored in the South by what word? Redemption, a sacred word to convince people that terrorism was not only upright but had a religious cast, that the people who overthrew those governments were redeemers. And it is embedded in our very vocabulary of words like carpetbagger and scalawag. Ardent liberals use those words and don't realize that they are buying into the inversion of history that took place apace for the 50 years after the Civil War. And not just in the South, but also in the North, where the center of the eugenics movement that defined a racial hierarchy was in the Ivy League. Louis Agassiz, anybody here from Boston, there are statues of Louis Agassiz all over the Boston area. He is the founder of the discoverer of the Ice Age, the founder of the National Academy of Sciences. He taught that black people were a subhuman species, that they weren't even human. And his successors in the late 19th century argued for a scientific hierarchy of races. That's what eugenics was. It defined our law. It was illegal for people to seek immigration or naturalized U.S. citizenship unless they were free white persons. That was the legal standard. And the scientists who grew up in the anti-immigration leagues out of the Ivy League in that period welcomed the scientific challenge to be able to classify the races scientifically and hierarchically. One of my favorite cases that culminated in an abrupt about-face by the Supreme Court. The Ozawa case was handed down in December 1922. Denying the application for citizenship of a Japanese gentleman named Ozawa, who had served in the Coast Guard for 20 years, lived in the United States as an immigrant, applied for citizenship, and it was turned down on the grounds that he was not, under the scientific application of the legal requirement to be a free white person, he was not a person of the Caucasian race. Caucasian was the scientific standard for who was white, because the courts have been arguing, who's white? Is a Lebanese person white? Is this that or the other? And the court ruled that Mr. Ozawa was not eligible to be considered a free white person, even though he claimed that he was white and he'd been living among Americans, because he was not Caucasian. Well, that law stood for exactly 2 months, until the case of Bagot Thind, T-H-I-N-D, reached the Supreme Court, and they decided it in February 1923. Lawyers for Thind argued that he was a Caucasian, descended from a high caste Punjabi Hindu, and that they argued before the Supreme Court that he was as repulsed by the idea of marrying a low caste Hindu as American white people were by the notion of marrying a black person, and that he was a Caucasian. And the court took testimony revealing that the term Caucasian had entered the scientific lexicon solely on the basis of a German sociologist named Johann von Blumenbach, who in 1794 received a skull from the Caucasus and said it looked a lot like his German skulls, and therefore people from Germany may have descended from the Caucasus. That is the entire scientific basis on which people to this day think they're saying something especially full of expertise when they distinguish the Caucasian race. And the experts who discovered all of this also said that, yes, Mr. Thind was a Caucasian, and so were certain Laplanders, Polynesians, and Hamites, whatever Hamites are. Anyway, it disturbed the Supreme Court so much that they said they overturned their own ruling from 2 months before and said that free white person means Caucasian only as that term is understood by the common man. In other words, they threw out the pretense of ethnology and science as soon as it contradicted popular prejudice. That's what we lived with until the civil rights era. It took 10 years after the Brown decision of 1954, which was a lofty pronouncement that racial segregation of black children was a denial of the constitutional premise of equal citizenship, and it was almost instantly confronted with the Emmett Till lynching a year later in Mississippi, in which the killers were acquitted boastfully, as they boasted their way out of the after committing an atrocious lynching. This was the confrontation between our racial platitudes and our racial reality. It took a nonviolent movement by a preposterously small number of people suffering for 10 years to lift race up again up to the surface by 1964, where Chairman Smith felt that he had to introduce the Sex Amendment, trying to hold this thing off. But it couldn't. What happened then was that race came to the surface and it opened all these doors that are still being opened to this day. But the point that I most want to make to you is that our politics are as inverted and our memory and as polluted about the memory of this as they were about the Civil War in the 50 years after the Civil War. Instead of our reality being, this is an amazing lesson for the expansion of progress in the name of we the people that has spread to disabled people, elderly people, senior citizens, immigrants from all over the world. People to this day argue that the Immigration Reform Act of 1965 did not intend to open America to naturalize citizenship of people from all over the world, that it was not idealistic, that it is totally an accident. But if you go and listen to the speech that Johnson gave, this followed immediately after the Voting Rights Act. He said, I've only got a day. Where's my goddamn immigration bill? We got a chance to pass it now. The Southerners are prostrate. And he went up to the Statue of Liberty and stood there and signed it and said, the National Origins Act that is confined naturalized citizenship basically to the countries of Northern Europe for all these years out of that eugenics movement is in the ash bin. Henceforth, American citizenship will be on a first-come, first-served basis to all people in the world, and never again will the twin barriers of prejudice and privilege shadow the gate to freedom. He said that, and now invisibly, the country has been changed literally and metaphorically in its sense of citizenship, where we are more comfortable than we think that American citizenship is an idea. It's not like being French. It's not language. It's not culture. It's an idea of equal citizenship. But the appreciation for that and for what happened in 1965 is suppressed by the fact that our politics immediately started to deny the fact that a black-led movement opened those stubborn gates of freedom for everyone. We don't remember. And we don't remember in part because of the psychological avoidances that have occurred in American history whenever race does come to the surface. New York Times v. Sullivan, as far as I know, is still the controlling case on libel. But very few law students who read it today understand how suffused that case was in race. The whole basis of that case was that in 1960, when the sit-in movement came, Alabama was so upset about it that when they had demonstrations in the state capitol, they filed a lawsuit by the mayor of Montgomery, Alabama, the governor of Alabama, and a whole slew of public officials filed libel cases against preachers in Alabama who signed an ad saying that this was a good thing, saying that this ad made an error. It said that they were singing as they demonstrated at the state capitol. It said they were singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee," when in fact they were singing "America the Beautiful." That's an ad. That's a mistake. It's up to the jury whether it's libelous, and they piled on millions of dollars of libel judgments to break the back of the civil rights movement against not only all these ministers, including Ralph Abernathy and Fred Shuttlesworth, but also against the New York Times. But the court, of course, could not say the courts of Alabama are infected with racism. This is a preposterous case. That this is the large, by 100 times the largest libel judgment that's ever been handed down by the courts of Alabama. Instead, they had to invent a new constitutional approach that so submerged race that today most people who study that case don't realize that race was involved. That is a prototype for how we change and lose our appreciation for the centrality of race, not only as an obstacle of freedom, but as an inspiration and a lesson for how we open the gates to new freedom. So that's 1964, New York Times v. Sullivan. In that same year, our two political parties did an abrupt face that by the standards of history is about face that is unprecedented. The Democrats, who had been the party of solid South white supremacy for 100 years since the Civil Rights Movement, began to inch toward the notion of being the party of civil rights on the strength of Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And, critical thing, only 9 months later, please read the speech, the whole speech, not just the "We Shall Overcome" speech, during Selma, when he said, "I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy." In that speech, in the first couple of paragraphs, he put the 600 all-black nonviolent demonstrators who were assaulted on Pettus Bridge, he said that they were in the pantheon that reveals the secret heart of America, and that they were the foot soldiers for American patriotism alongside Lexington and Concord and Appomattox. He put a nonviolent group of all black people on the same vanguard of patriotism with the iconic leaders of freedom in the United States. That notion was unpalatable to most Americans, and it has been suppressed in our politics. Dr. King said as early as 1963 that Wallaceism is bigger than Wallace. 1963 is the same year that Wallace came into the governorship of Alabama, George Wallace, saying segregation now, today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. All he could talk about was race. It was reminiscent of the 18th century. By the end of that year, after the Birmingham church bombing, after the March on Washington, Wallace, and Dr. King recognized it, he said he has retooled his stump speech into little gems that do not mention race at all, let alone segregation. And in fact, Wallace said that to talk about race was inherently favoritism, and that he had never denigrated a person in his entire life on the basis of his race, that his whole purpose was to restore local government against a centralized bureaucracy of pointy-headed bureaucrats, tyrannical judges, and tax-and-spend legislators, and that he wanted to restore local government. And he invented the vocabulary of modern politics, and he transmuted hostility and race into that was unrespectable and no longer respectable, into a respectable hostility toward the notion of government itself, so that we are blinded to the fact that we've had all of this progress through the doors of equal citizenship for 50 years that were open by the civil rights movement 50 years ago, and that provided you with all the work that you do and all the work that you face going forward. Today, you'd have a hard time finding many students who realize that the partisan structure of the United States was turned upside down only on the strength of the race issue 50 years ago, and that it is only racial politics that has the remarkable ability to cover its tracks so completely that nobody speaks of that any longer. We are trapped in a gridlock and in a cynical era in which people routinely say that we're in gridlock and we're in an era of cynicism, but nobody investigates why, where does it come from. The underpinnings of gridlock are racial, even statistically. Statisticians can tell you that. But nobody wants to inquire into that because we know that that's the case, and because we prefer, as we did after the Civil War, to live in a world that makes us less fearful. Now we're ending another 50 years, 50 years of self-deception, that masked empirical progress. I think race is bubbling again to the surface of American politics in a way to make us confront the fact that our politics are imprisoned in a cynicism about what we the people means that is not capable of addressing the great challenges that confront us all in the future when we are displacing millions of jobs and when employment is so important. Your jobs are so important. And what I'm saying here is that I don't think you can do your jobs until our politics is healthier and more balanced about the reality of what the capabilities of government are and have been, and how race is the central headlight and the central indicator and barometer of health in our politics. So that's what I think going forward. I think you have an enormous challenge for you. I am hoping that we're ending another 50-year cycle of deception about our politics, that people will realize that we ought to be more optimistic about the prospects and what we can do when we are honest with ourselves and facing difficult. It's not that it's easy. It's certainly not easy. The civil rights movement was not easy. None of these things was easy. But we did make progress when we broke down the emotional barriers that kept people pushing these things away and saying that's somebody else's problem. For me personally, I can tell you that it was Birmingham in May of 1963. I was 16 then. By that time, I had been scared of the civil rights movement for all of my life, and believe me, most black people were too. Most of the people who say that they were involved in the civil rights movement and were marching are lying. They weren't. It was a very, very small minority of a minority, and they were quarreling among themselves about what to do. But nevertheless, it kept going, and I finally went to my mother. Music got me. A lot of things broke through to me. How come it is that my white friends who are hostile to black people are the very ones that will sneak out to the Herndon Stadium to hear Ray Charles? Where is all of this coming from? This is very profound. It seems to me like my white generation of white teenagers thinks that we're going to grow up and wear neckties and use big words, but that black people have the keys to the human heart. That's why we like Sam Cooke and Jerry Butler and Jackie Wilson. There was music. I finally went to my mother and I said, Mom, when I get really old and stable. I was planning to be a doctor, like maybe 30. I'm going to do something about this race issue. And it seems like it wasn't a week later that I open up the newspaper and turn on the TV and I see little children marching into dogs and fire hoses in Birmingham as young as 6 years old. I have photographs of six-year-olds doing this, and they were mostly girls. And they were singing the same songs that I sang in Sunday school, and they weren't waiting until they were 30. And for me, it broke down my emotional resistance to saying somebody should do something about that when it's convenient. And I think that happened for the whole country, that the race issue suddenly got people so that only 2 years later, after Pettus Bridge, after between the time that Pettus Bridge happened and Lyndon Johnson recognized it as in the pantheon of American freedom, Dr. King called for people to come and march over that same bridge, and within 36 hours, before Travelocity and Expedia.com and everything, within 36 hours, he had 800 people from as far away as Hawaii on that same bridge, mostly clergy, ready to march. That's the kind of mobilization, but it took a long time to get it, a lot of awakening to get it. And I'm hoping that that's the kind of mobilization that is percolating again in this country to give us an accurate sense of our own history and an accurate sense of how important the work you're doing to try to preserve jobs and to preserve justice going forward in an economy that is causing strain and stress on people. To do your job in the context of a true appreciation for how valuable our commitment to justice is and how valuable the notion is that we are practicing law, you are practicing law in a legal system whose founding principle and spirit is in the very first three words of the Constitution, we the people. Thank you. Well, thank you. I'm happy to answer questions on any subject, and it doesn't have to be anything that we mentioned here. Any subject except a correction on the legal citations I mentioned. You keep those to yourselves, please. There are three microphones. So if anybody has a question, I'll be happy to address them until we get the hook.
Good morning. My name is Paul Malika. I'm from Chicago. And thank you very much for coming this morning. What do you feel the U.S. can do to pay its centuries-long debt to black Americans? There has obviously been in the last year a lot of discussion again because of the Atlantic story about reparations. But we face a problem that our Supreme Court has declared that the Equal Protection Clause prevents any race-conscious remedies. Uh-huh. So how do we go about the solution to this problem?
Well, I think, by the way, the author of that Atlantic article, Ta-Nehisi Coates, is one of the screenwriters in the room with me trying to make this HBO miniseries, along with David Simon, the guy who did The Wire. So I'm wrestling with his issues every time we meet on this. I would say pretty much the same thing that Ta-Nehisi says, which is that the physical... The actual issue of reparations and compensation is less important than an honest conversation about where this came from and a recognition that race relations is, as I argue, the stubborn gate. It's not only the indication of where we failed, but it's the indication of where we break through for progress that benefits everyone. These are profound issues, and I'll just mention a couple to you. I get in a lot of trouble when I go to black groups today saying, I recommend that you take greater credit publicly for the benefits of the black-led civil rights movement that have accrued broadly to the whole society since then. And by that, I'm including white Southerners whose economy, used to be the hookworm belt, and now we're the sun belt, okay? The mayor of Atlanta told me that the day the Civil Rights Bill passed, the city of Atlanta started building a sports stadium on land that it didn't own for a team that it hadn't found, located, and brought the Atlanta Braves here. So the South wasn't even fit for professional sports. So these benefits spread all over, including seniors and so on and so forth. But what I get from them is, if we do that, we will be diminishing our cause. We have huge causes now that are purely black, about the school-to-prison pipeline, about the jobs crisis. And if we start talking about deal with race, deal with us, and recognize us historically and politically today, we will diminish our own message. And so they see that as a very dangerous thing to start talking, because they think essentially that white society will seize the benefits for itself and ignore the agenda of black people. And so these are difficult discussions, but I think the real thing in bubbling up here is a recognition that it has always been that we are our best when we realize how blinded we have been right down into our vocabulary about race, so that we can make our politics. It would be great to me if, and a lot of this is our history. Our history is poorly taught. Everywhere I go, teachers say that if they're a decent history teacher, they're being pressured to switch to English because that's all their schools get tested on. And history is the only way we learn what citizenship means. So, kids still learn, if they learn anything about civil rights, they learn Rosa Parks and I Have the Dream, and they still learn redemption as the lesson of the end of the Civil War. So even civil rights is a euphemism that was introduced into our vocabulary by the NAACP in World War I, because they knew that if they used a term for racial justice that had race in it, that it would be rejected. So they said civil rights. So rights pertaining to citizenship, we unconsciously associate with race relations, but we don't talk about why we do that. So I don't have a solution about reparations itself, but I agree with Ta-Nehisi that what we really need to do is begin to surface how deeply, even in our vocabulary, we underestimate both the problem and the promise of dealing with politics through race. I'll probably get in trouble here, but this is legal. The word racist. What is the literal meaning of the word racist? What is the literal meaning of any term? It draws what we mean from it wholly from our attitudes toward the root word, which is race. Okay. Therefore, it is radioactive. Call somebody a racist, you want to end that conversation. You want to defend yourself, or you want to use it as a weapon. I'm hoping that we can move toward the day that the word racist will approach its literal meaning, and our attitude toward race will be neutral, so that we'll realize that rather than a weapon, that race is a flavor of kinship. That's really what happened. So that racist will approach a meaning like an artist, or a scientist, or a machinist. In other words, somebody who recognizes that it is in race, that it is a vast lesson for how we relate to one another, and that a racist is somebody who embraces that and wants to talk about it as much as they want to talk about sports. When that happens, and we're all racists in the sense that we recognize the contributions and the obstacles that race has been, We'll be ready to talk about reparations.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Taylor, thank you for being here. I love your 50-year increments. I'm going to tell that to my kids, so they won't understand it, I don't think. But my name is Cyrus Mary. I'm a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and most of my clients, or large number, are African-American managers, professionals, and a lot of times we do class actions or we get a lot of data. And in my view, it seems like the African-American community has gone backwards during the age of Obama when he's been the president. And look, it just decimated in corporate America in terms of, you know, positions and moving up. And I think we've gone tremendously backwards in the last 7 years, just looking at it from an empirical point of view of representation. And so my question to you is, could you just address the issue of Obama and the paradox of race during his presidency?
It is a paradox of race. You know, a couple of years ago, I don't know, when they had the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, the night before the march, I was on the NewsHour, interviewed by Gwen Ifill. And at the end of the interview, she asked me if there was anything that I hoped that Obama would recognize when he went to give his talk the next day at the march. And I said, well, I wish that he could recognize, but I know this isn't true, that the underpinnings of gridlock are racial, that he could say that, that we need to investigate that. And Gwen Ifill almost fell off her chair. She said, are you saying that the underpinnings of gridlock are racial? And I said, yes, it's obvious to me. I mean, look at the composition of the districts in the House of Representatives. They are statistically significant. They are beyond statistically significant. And she said, well, this is off the air when it all ended. She said, I'm going to interview the president tomorrow after his speech, and with your permission, I would like to ask him if he thinks the underpinnings of gridlock are racial. And she said, but I'm not going to ask him unless you let me say that it's your idea. So I said, fine. So the next day, at the end of an interview, which, by the way, was mostly about foreign policy, even after the March on Washington, it was about Iraq and war and this, that, and the other. At the very end, she said, this civil rights historian said yesterday that the underpinnings of race, of gridlock, are racial, and Obama went off on like a 400-word sentence. It went all over the place. And basically, the gravamen of what he said was that it's not my race. My race is not the underpinnings of gridlock because it was here before me. And of course, my point is, yes, that is the point. It is bigger than you, but it is, but you, I know this to be true, his whole staff gets the heebie-jeebies whenever he mentions race because they know that they're going to get pounced on for in exactly the language that George Wallace invented in 1963. It's favoritism. You're playing the race card and so on and so forth, so they don't do it. So I don't think that President Obama, tragically, has been allowed to share his life's experience. After all, he's been a black person his whole life, and he's lived all over the world and is now president of a country that is trying to deal not only with itself but with this whole world. And the one bit of category of wisdom that he can't share is his own experience as a black person. If he does, we go nuts. And I think, I mean, all presidents get gray, but I do think that's part of his frustration. I don't even think he's going to, this is a prediction, I don't even think, and I hope I'm wrong, I don't think he's going to talk much about race even after he leaves the presidency, because then it will be unbecoming. That prison is pretty strong. So in that sense, I think it's there. I think it's sad, and I think that basically the history shows that people will use racial developments however they want to. You can remember whatever you want to remember, and what they're going to say is, we don't have a race problem in America because we elected Barack Obama, even though Barack Obama can hardly mention the fact that he's black. So I don't think he's made things worse, but I think he has exposed for anyone who's willing to see the fact that the race issue has always been much deeper than any one person in an office. It's like Dr. King. He never gets the credit. His entire staff was against his going to Chicago. Somebody just asked me something from Chicago, saying, if we go to Chicago, we're going to lose the press, because the press loves it when we go, the northern press loves it when we're in Selma. But when we go to Chicago, they're going to say we're over our heads and we don't know what we're doing. And Dr. King says, we have an opportunity fleeting in history to demonstrate that the race problem is not and never has been purely sectional. And even that we have to do it no matter what. And that, of course, is the prophetic end of Dr. King's career, was that series of steps that he took as the movement was losing steam, but to leave behind a message that it is national in Chicago, that it is about war in Vietnam, and that it is about poverty with the sanitation workers in Memphis. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. I just I want to say thank you for making the connections that continue to surprise America. Your connections between race and all that we've been through from a civil rights history and college sports today is groundbreaking, and I just want to thank you. I have sort of a selfish request, but I want to explain why before I make the ask, because it's not necessarily for me. I had the privilege of marching on the 50th anniversary, on the actual 50th anniversary of the Selma March. I had the privilege of being part of the National Park Service event that celebrated that 50th anniversary, and we marched from Selma to Montgomery on the 50 years after those who came before us did it. And we studied things, and it was a group of 300 people, 150 of whom were 25 and under. And they see those connections. They don't know you and your work as well as the over 25 crowd did. But I would like to ask for any of those in this room who would like to participate in it, if you will indulge us, if you will take a group picture, because these kids are connected, they are moving via their smartphones, and they are all fighting for their individual Selmas. I would love to be able to post on the National Park Service private page that we share a picture with you, and to share some of the quotes that I've been typing on my phone.
Well, that's a lot easier question than this one over here. So, yes, sir, you know, I did do the march from Selma to 54 miles is a long way. I did it with a group of Spelman students a few years ago, marched the whole way. It's an amazing experience, and I hope to do it again one day, because when you march through Lowndes County, where the Black Panther Party, the real Black Panther Party, was born of sharecropper women, and another thing that's totally suppressed in mythology about American history. You see it. So I'd love to take a photograph. Thank you very much.
One or two more questions.
One or two?
Yeah.
All right.
There's two over there. Bob and then.
I'll try to be
last two, sorry.
I'll try to be brief. I'm Paul Mary from Boston, and I have heard of Louis Agassiz. He was a professor at Harvard, and they don't talk about him much anymore. But my question to you is, I think it's possible to make a case that one of the major parties of the United States has, political parties, has been taken over and is under the influence of a relatively small minority, but that relatively small minority is vehemently and bitterly opposed to the progress that you're talking about, that we've been talking about, that we've been trying to make in relationships amongst Americans. And my question to you is, so that minority has undue influence, and it has, I think it has something to do with the gridlock in Washington. I think it's a pretty obvious thing, really. But is there a solution? Do you have any suggestions or ideas about how to grapple with this? And, of course, part of the one dimension of it is that there is, it seems to me, there is now much greater access for that vocal minority to mass media than there used to be when I was growing up? Thank you.
Yes, I think that's a very good question, and I'm just going to give a I'm not going to get into the practicalities, but I'm going to get into the dream part of it. My analysis is that that minority that you're talking about pursuing its own self-interest, a selfish minority, not an ideological minority, but a self-interest that I think basically would prefer its self-interest over democracy itself in a pinch, okay? The hold that they have is over not themselves, but their ability to convince lots of other people that are not self-interested so much about this attitude that government is bad and that government is terrible and that really what protects you in America as your guarantee of liberty is taking your 45 into Starbucks for coffee and blinding you to the fact that it's our collective freedom that we've built that protects us. You've got to separate them from the constituency that they've got convinced in this whole notion of government is bad. And you've got to try to separate that because by themselves, they have tremendous power and economic force, but it takes the hold they have over lots of other people that have inherited George Wallace's political vocabulary. And that's the opportunity to break the link. Yes, ma'am. Last
question and answer.
Okay. I'll make it quick. I want to make a couple of points and then ask a question. You know, I agree with you that as a country, we have sort of resolved in our minds somehow that the whole issue of race is over, and that's far from truth. I mean, many people think that, well, there was slavery, you know, there was a civil war, there was Reconstruction, Rosa Parks sat down, there was a march on Washington, the Rights Acts were passed, Obama was elected, done. We are not, in fact, teaching, though, about the real issue of race. And worse than that, I think people feel castigated when they start to talk about race. We have not only made it such that we don't teach about it, but anybody who talks about it publicly is really sort of demonized. And I think you alluded to that when you talked about Obama mentioning race in his speech. I think we as a country have got to have an honest dialogue. If you look at the situation in South Africa after apartheid, they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that helped them move forward. We have never had a national conversation in this country about that. And I think what we have to remember, too, is like Dr. King said in Selma, that it cannot be on the onus of African Americans to be the ones to raise up and discuss the issue of race, because all of us have to talk about that. And people who have benefited have to actually raise those conversations. For the kids who are going to school and there's no mention of them in the textbooks, you know, where do they draw their pride? Where do they draw their sense of self and their history? So I'm glad to hear you talk about this morning, and I think that those of us who live in the disparate states ought to be asking our elected governors and senators and congresspeople, putting it on them to say, we got to deal with this issue. It can't just be Barack Obama. It cannot be.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. I know we're out of time. The only response I would say to you is that the language of having a conversation about race is limited because I guarantee you what people think is, okay, we want to have one conversation so we can put it aside. And that's how they interpret it. And what I'm saying is we want to embrace the subject of race until everybody instead wants to be a racist in the sense of making it the key of how they learn instead of being afraid of being labeled a racist. And that's a wholly different thing than saying, oh gosh, we got to talk about race until you can convince yourself that you're comfortable and you're defensible on it. So we have to embrace it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Branch. Speaking of civil rights, we've got some breaking news.
Thank you, Alan. The Supreme Court got it right. Same-sex marriage, 5-4. And it's real this time.
Thank you. Thank you. gratitude and appreciation for keeping the civil rights movement alive for future generations. Celebrating 30 years of employee rights advocacy, June 26, 2015. Thank you.